Thank you, Marcia. Good evening, everybody, or good afternoon, as it is where I am. My name is Mick. I'm an alcoholic. I'm an atheist. My sobriety date is the 24th of February, 1999, and my home group is the Bulimba Freethinker Secular Group, which meets at the Bulimba Library, 7:30 every Thursday night, and you're all welcome. And it also goes out on Zoom, as Marcia is aware. We're a hybrid meeting. Now, that's how I normally open my share at any time, and particularly if I'm sharing at a traditional AA meeting, which I don't do a lot of these days, but occasionally I do. And the reason I do that is not to be arrogant and not to be confrontational by advertising my atheism, nor is it to be boastful about the length of my sobriety. But who I'm talking to is that person who I'm pretty certain is going to be in the room, and there's probably going to be more than one of them, who has some reservations about the God thing in AA. Now, that may be a newcomer who's been belted around the ears by their sponsor and told to fake it till they make it, right after they've been told that this is a program of rigorous honesty. Or it could be somebody who's been sober for a considerable period of time and has never really been comfortable, but knows no other way. Now, and I do this because I wish there had been somebody in that meeting in 1999 to get up and say that, because it would have saved me an awful lot of heartache over the years. Now, to go back to the start, I was born in 1947. In a farming community in rural Australia, two alcoholic parents. Alcohol and alcoholism has been a part of my life literally from as far back as I can remember. My parents were relatively well-to-do farming people. They were Irish, they were Catholic, and that's pretty much a prerequisite to be an alcoholic. But they were fairly highly respected in the community, and they were, as I know now, both of them were binge drinkers. Living on a farm tends to lend itself to that form of drinking, because the hotel's not, or the bar's not just around the corner. It's a considerable drive on bad roads to get to town. So going for a drink probably meant driving, you know, into town, spending the day at the bar, and then driving home again. Now, back in the 1950s and 60s that I'm talking about here, no earlier than that, not your 1950s, you know, drink driving and what have you wasn't the issue that it is today. And I don't ever remember my dad bringing a car, actually. I've seen him get home and fall out of the car. But somehow or other, we managed to drive. My mother was a different sort of a drinker again. Once again, a binge drinker. But my mother would probably only drink, I think, from what I can remember, two or three times a year. And when she did, it was a doozy. It was a doozy. And almost always at home, Mum, because in those days, and I can only speak for Australia, it really wasn't sort of the done thing. For women, women who considered themselves to be of a bit of class anyway, to be drinking in bars or what have you. So the drinking was done mainly at home for Mum. So that was sort of that was what I grew up with. I can remember Alcoholics Anonymous being mentioned in the home when I was, I'm suspecting here, somewhere no more than about 8 or 10. So I'm probably talking late 50s here. That would have been only about 10 years after AA came to Australia. And the discussion in the household was that this particular friend, I still remember his name, it was Fonce Moylan, had gone to this bloody thing called AA. And my parents were somewhat perplexed about it. Why would he go and do something like that? And the consensus was, after they discussed it a bit, was that, well, it was probably his wife's fault, because she was well known to be a bitch. And she hadn't, she wouldn't go into the pubs with him. She wouldn't go to the pub with him. So the poor bugger had to go to the pub on his own, and then she'd be home looking to give him the rounds of the kitchen when he got home. AA was discussed, but in somewhat non-flattering terms. My childhood wasn't terrible. I suppose my parents loved me, but they didn't. There wasn't much demonstration of that, either towards each other or towards me or to my sister, who came along some 6 years later. But that's how it was. Now, my mother was to pass away when I was 15, not as a direct result of alcoholism, but it was just a cancer thing, probably something which by today's medical standards may well have been treatable, but certainly in the early 60s wasn't. So I suppose if you'd have asked me at the age of 12 or so, set a timer on myself here, I would have told you I'd never drink that stuff, because I'd seen too much of what it could do. But yet at the age of 15, which was shortly after Mum died, I started drinking. I was already a somewhat willful child, because my parents really had little control and very little interest in controlling me. I was smart, and I had the school results to show that I was smart. I would top my class. Went from being at 15, scholastically well regarded, playing competitive schoolboy sport in a couple of sports at elite levels, to the time I was 17, I was living virtually on the street in Melbourne, in the capital city. And I would have told you that it was because my mum died, and because they wouldn't let me stay home and run the farm, and because of a whole heap of other reasons. I think the most significant reason is that I had been introduced to alcohol. Now, when I look back on it now, for almost from the time I took my first drink, I exhibited the hallmarks of the alcoholic, insofar as there has never been a time in my entire life that, once having picked up a drink, that I was able to guarantee either my consumption or my behaviour. And to me, that has been that. And that was true at 15 at my first drink, and it was true at somewhere a bit over 50 at my last drink, my last drink to this point in time, and that which I hope will be my last drink ever, one day at a time. That's not looking too bad at this stage. So there we are. So at 15, at 17, 18, I would have considered it an advantage at the time. When I look back on it now, it was probably my greatest curse, in that I always looked older than my age. I was quite tall. I was and am a little over 6 foot tall, and sort of fairly sort of, I suppose, streetwise. So I could very easily pass myself off as being of legal drinking age and older. Not that anybody really cared much back in those days. Didn't really matter. You know, being of drinking age involved having money to put on the bar, and that was about as far as ID went. So I was living the life of a grown man. I remember one particular time when I was actually, and my fortunes would sort of fluctuate. You know, I'd be going all right for a while. I'd get a job, and then I'd wind up with the arse out of my pants, and that sort of came and went. At one point in time, I wasn't doing too bad, and I got into a boarding house. And it was a fairly strictly run boarding house, and the old lady who ran it had a heart of gold. She really did, and she sort of took me in and tried to mother me, and that boarding house was used by the State Electricity Commission, who used to send linesmen, country boys, down to Melbourne to go to schools down there to learn how to be linesmen, I guess. And they used to stay at this, some of them used to stay at this boarding house. Now, the old girl who ran the thing was forever getting up these blokes about taking young Michael out and getting him on the grog. Now, the reality was that it was fairly widely known, apparently, around the State Electricity Commission, that if you can get into this particular boarding house in Oakley, there's a young bloke there who knows the back door of every sly grog, and every dive, in Melbourne. This was back in the days when it was 6 o'clock closing and no Sunday trading. And I'd made him a business to, so I was a bloody tour guide. So I never paid for a drink. So that I could roll back in this boarding house blind, rotten drunk every night. And this old girl's young cook of these blokes were taking me out. She had it all wrong. I was taking them out. And that was at the age of about 17 or 18. So I was well on the way then. Blackouts were becoming pretty much a part of my life. I can remember on one occasion waking up not alone, and looking around and spotted this woman who I'd never seen before in my life, so far as I was concerned. It was probably a few years older than me. And you know, that awkward question of who are you and where am I? The suburb that she named was a bloody long way from where I knew I'd started off the night before. How did we get here? Sit in your car. Now, I was 17, and that's below the driving age. I didn't have a car. I didn't have a license. Wasn't old enough to have a license. And there was a Holden station wagon. Holden's an Australian model of car. Sitting out the front, which apparently I'd driven her home in. Never seen the car before in my life either. And so far as I know, that Holden car may still be sitting on the side of the road in Broadmeadows, 60 years later, because I haven't been back to get it. But that was sort of fairly typical of the sort of caper that I was getting up to. Now, at around about the age of 18, I went back up the country. And I'd actually, on a visit up there, I'd actually ran into a girl that I'd gone to school with. Actually, I'd ran into her father in a pub, more to the point, and formed a friendship, which was to become a relationship with this girl, and I subsequently moved back to a country town. Now, at about this time, as I say, my mother had died a few years earlier. My father was deep in the grip of alcoholism, And I tried to, I was too, but I didn't realise it. I thought I was doing all right. So I went looking for help for Dad. And I actually went to the library. I don't know why I did this, but I did. I actually went to the local library and I found a book called Alcoholics Anonymous. Apparently the local AA group had donated this book to the library. So I took the book home and I read it. And I can't remember now. You know, it was a long time ago, and I flat out remember what I had for breakfast. But I don't remember now whether I read the book in its entirety. But I obviously skimmed enough of it to get an idea of what it was about. And I could see that Dad really, really needed this. And that was an opinion that my father was never to share. And the sad fact is that my father died of this disease when he was some years, quite a few years, probably 10, 12 years actually, younger than I am now. So that was that. And that was at the age of about 19. By this time I'd married this childhood sweetheart. That was always bloody doomed for disaster because we were a pair of kids. I was 19, she was 20. She came from a somewhat dysfunctional family background. We were both escapees and saw our salvation in each other. And it was never to be. You know, it was a decent woman. But it was never to be. But we did have four kids. To get back to the timeline, it was about 2 years later that I, at the age of about 21, that I realised that my alcoholism was kicking in big time, and some of what I'd read in this book, obviously came back to me, and I attended my first meeting under my own steam anyway of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got sober. And one day at a time, I didn't pick up a drink. And that was to turn into a period of nearly 10 years of sobriety between the ages of roughly 21 and 31. And we're talking now, you know, late 60s, mid-60s to mid-70s. And you know, a lot of stuff happened and not all of it's relevant. But what I do remember is, and this is sort of the important thing, is the Alcoholics Anonymous that I became associated with at that time was very, very fellowship-based rather than program-based. You know, the 12 steps were up on the wall and the big book was on the table. And I don't remember seeing much other literature in the 60s. But it really wasn't, and there wasn't a lot of reading or whatever you'd done. Some of these blokes, and they were mainly blokes back in those days, were, you know, they were farm labourers and truck drivers and whatever. Some of them were illiterate, you know, certainly weren't academics. So the basic thrust of staying sober was you don't pick up the first drink. And you do that for one day. You go for one day without picking up the first drink. Now, if one day is too long, chop it back to half a day. If half a day is too long, chop it back to an hour. And if an hour is too long, chop it back to however long it takes you to find a phone and ring another member. And like, this is long before mobile phones. And get to meetings, get to plenty of meetings. Now, getting to plenty of meetings involved the city that I lived in, small city that I lived in, had two meetings, I think. But in the towns around it, within probably up to an hour's drive, there were meetings pretty well every night of the week. And some of these groups consisted of no more than maybe one bloke, maybe two, who on a Monday or a Tuesday or a Wednesday, whatever the designated night was, would front up and open the local church hall or whatever and hope that somebody would turn up to have a meeting with. And usually somebody did. So we had meetings in the car on the way to the meetings. We had meetings in the car on the way back. So it was full on fellowship. And then it was suggested after a while that after you'd sort of, you know, got this sort of a little bit sorted and you'd spent a few days, one day at a time, had become a few weeks and maybe a few months, that you have a bit of a look at the trail of shit you'd left behind. And do something about cleaning that up, you know, make some reparation to family and to people that you'd harmed. And that pretty well basically was it. You know, that was pretty well it. And it worked. It's still working for some of those blokes. I'm still in contact with some of those guys who now have well over 50 years of sobriety, blokes that I knew back then, who've got a well over 50 years of sobriety. And their attitude really hasn't changed. Now, at the end of that 10-year period, I was kicking ass. That earlier marriage had failed, not entirely related to my alcoholism either. That marriage failed actually in sobriety, although my earlier behaviour probably hadn't helped it. But that's the reality of the thing. And that marriage did fail. And I remarried to the woman who's my wife today. I think we celebrate 46 years this year. But I had a small but successful business going, and I was just on 30 years of age. The world was my oyster. I was kicking ass big time. And what happened was that I forgot I was an alcoholic. Now, how does one forget something as basic as the fact that one is an alcoholic? I'll tell you how you do it. You get busy. You get successful. You get too busy. You get people to see, places to go, money to earn, you know, trucks to drive, and that's what I was, an interstate truck driver, and all of this stuff. And suddenly the time available for going to AA meetings and involving one in AA gets narrower and narrower, until without even thinking about it, there was never a day when I got up in the morning and said, bugger this, I'm not going back to AA. It was a more gradual process until a time came when it was, I'm not even sure how long it was now, but it was certainly weeks, maybe even months, that I hadn't been to a meeting. And I found myself, as I mentioned before, I was an interstate truck driver, which meant being away for a fair bit of the time. I found myself stuck in another city, about converting to about 600 miles from home. I couldn't get a load out, so I was stuck there overnight. And that had happened 100 times before. And the only place to get a decent feed was at a hotel. And that had happened a million times before too. Exaggeration, several times before. I went down with a heap of other blokes. We jumped in a few trucks and headed down to the pub, and somebody bought a beer and put it in front of me. Aussies tend to drink in what they call shouts, schools, so somebody bought a round of drinks and put a beer in front of me. And that had happened heaps of times before too. Now, the difference was that on previous occasions I'd said, oh, shit, sorry, should have said something. Somebody else can have that. I'll go and get myself a Coke. That night I didn't. I picked up that beer and I drank it. Now, I think in the back of my mind was if I thought at all, I can always go back. If this doesn't work, I can always go back to AA. It didn't work, because that very first night I got into trouble, not a lot of trouble by alcoholic standards, but certainly the sort of trouble that your average social drinker doesn't have to worry about. I woke up the next morning slumped over the wheel of my still running truck on the side of a freeway facing the wrong way, that I had no idea where I was or how I got there. And how the coppers didn't get me, I've got no bloody idea, but they didn't. And I awoke, the sun belting in on the back of my head. In those days, I even had hair, but it was still belting in on the back of my head. And my first thought, you would think, would be, shit, that didn't work. I better get back to AA. My first thought instead was, shit, that didn't work. I'm going to have to do that different next time. And that's insanity. That is dead set insanity. And I continued trying to do it different the next time for 22 years. And that's bloody white coat padded cell insanity. But that's what I did. Now, I'm not going to take you step by step through that 22 years. I know it's very late where you are. You'll all be asleep. But I will say I was probably what is sometimes, I guess, described as a functional alcoholic, insofar as I was still able to work, and I always did work. I always worked hard, and I always earned pretty fair money. The potential exists in the line of work that I was doing to earn pretty good money, but you really got to put the effort in to do it. But I was able to do that. And it was also important to me, because I needed to prove. First of all, I needed to prove to my wife. Now, that's something I need to go back to for a moment too. Bear in mind that my wife, who is still my wife today, that my wife had met and married me as a sober man. She met and married me sober. She knew that I was a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and had been for about, the timing's a bit messed up in my mind now, I think about 3 years, maybe longer, between the time with 76, until I drank again. So here she is, married to this bloke she's never bloody met, married to a bloke she's never met. And the miracle of it all is that she stuck with me. You know, there was a time, and it wasn't so far back either, when I had the temerity to suggest to her, my wife's about a 5'3" redhead. She takes no prisoners. And I did suggest to her that, I really can't have been all that bad. After all, you're stuck with me. Jesus. She advised me in no uncertain terms that she stuck with me only because she had nowhere else to go. She had nowhere else to go. How many women are stuck in that sort of position? You know, I never laid a hand on her. I mean, if you'd have accused me of abusing her, I would have been highly indignant. But the reality is I abused that woman for 20-odd years. You know, I abused her financially. I abused her emotionally. I abused her in every other way. And the fact that I didn't lay a hand on her, she'd have probably preferred a belting to some of the shit I dealt out. But as I say, it was important to me to maintain a facade, you know, to work hard. I had the big house. I used to, you know, I would have said to you, and I think I probably did say, how can I be an alcoholic with a big house, two cars and a boat and a driver? And that was, you know, I'd make it a point. I would never drink during the day. because that's what alcoholics do, you know. And I would even if I had business to do, have an evening, I would not drink. If I was expecting an important phone call, I would not drink until that business was attended to, and then I drink. And the quantity drank and the end result wouldn't be that much different. But instead of starting at 4 or 5 in the afternoon, I might leave it till 7 or 8. Now, you know, the reality is that whilst I was trying to prove that I wasn't an alcoholic, I was in fact proving that I am an alcoholic, because ordinary people, social drinkers, they can have a few drinks or whatever with their dinner and then still function and still do stuff. You know, I couldn't guarantee that I would, and I knew that I couldn't guarantee that I would. So the safest way for me was to stay away from it, you know. I was never one for going for liquid lunches, because I knew that lunch would develop into dinner and probably bloody breakfast. So I just didn't do that stuff. You know, barbecues were a bit of a different thing, because you had to sort of light the barbecue and what have you early in the morning to get it all heated up and what have you. Well, once the barbecue's lit, it's officially a social occasion, isn't it? So then you can drink. You know, and that was the sort of crazy bloody reasoning that I kept up with all those years. And you know, we when I look back on it now, in the same way as a child, I went from being that A student, champion sports person to nobody. I sort of did the same thing in my adult life. You know, I had a real skill for taking failure from the jaws of victory, because I could have a business, and I had some businesses that did quite well, but I'd always cock it up. I'd get too big for my boots, or I'd make some bad decisions under the influence of alcohol or whatever, and you know, it was so my poor wife and kids, they never bloody knew what was going on. I can remember on one occasion, I was doing all right. My wife had always been somewhat interested in music, so I bought her and the kids one of those Yamaha organ things, and that was, you know, and I was being a great bloke, you know. Well, look at what I'd done, you know. Bought her, and her and the kids loved it, and that was great for about 6 months, until some bloody financial disaster befell me, and that had to be sold for groceries. You know, how does a woman put up with that? Jesus. But she did. So from there we come to there was no particular sort of rock bottom or you know, there should be a dramatic story to tell here, shouldn't it? You know, I should be able to tell you that I rolled a truck drunk but I didn't. Never did, never even got done for DUI. You know, in all of those years, absolutely. I hesitate to use the word miraculous in this context, but shit, it wasn't too far off it. You know, there was nothing like that, but it just got worse and worse. And in 1999, my life was in tatters. It was still looking all right on the outside. If anybody, nobody, neighbours wouldn't have known. The big house was still there. Boat was probably gone, but there was a couple of cars there. But I was in deep shit. You know, yet another business was about to go down the gurgler. This time, whereas in the past I'd always sort of managed to quarantine the house from my business dealings, this time the house was in the mix. And that looked like going. My long suffering wife, she'd had a gutful. I could see it in her eyes. She'd had enough. And I had a moment of absolute clarity at about 4 o'clock one morning, and the devout and deluded would want me to tell you that it was a spiritual awakening. It wasn't. It was a moment of absolute and total bloody clarity. I realised, with what intellect I had left, that this had to stop. This had to stop, and I knew what was causing it. I'd known for all of that 20 odd years what was causing it. And I also knew what I had to do to bloody stop it. But I had resisted that all of that time. So that particular morning, I got up, and I still remember, and I don't know why I did this, and I It's not often I share this, actually, but I don't often share at this sort of length. That morning I got up and I rang every one of my six kids. Got some of them out of bed very early on that morning, 24th of February, 1999. Those who weren't, there was only, I think they'd all left home by that stage. I can't remember. Yeah, they had. And rang them and told them that I had realised that I was an alcoholic. I'd always known that I was an alcoholic, but now I was accepting it, and that it was my intention to go to an AA meeting that night and to do my best to repair the damage done. Now, I don't know. I was shutting off the bloody entry to the rabbit hole, shutting off my means of escape. I really don't know. I don't know. But that's what I did anyway. And that night I went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And one day at a time, I have refrained from picking up that first drink ever since. And that's now 23 years next month. But then something else sort of came into the mix. Now, I mentioned before that my first association with AA back in the 60s and 70s was fairly God-free, if you like. It was a program. Well, it wasn't so much a program as a fellowship. Now I came back in 1999 to an AA which had changed dramatically, or my perception of it changed anyway. I came back to an AA in 1999 that was just so full of religiosity that it really bloody floored me. And I struggled. Christ, I struggled. I was hearing things like, you can't possibly get sober. You can't possibly get sober without God. I was hearing things like, you need to read chapter 4, the big book. I had read chapter 4 and found it to be the most deceptive, the most insulting piece of literature I think I'd ever read, and realised after a while, as time went by, Bill Wilson wrote chapter 4. He also wrote chapter 6 to wives. Now, Bill Wilson was neither an agnostic nor a wife, and it shows. They were two chapters of the big book that he should never have written, and he did that against the advice of a lot of people. There were atheists in AA right at the very start. Jimmy Burwell, Hank Parkhurst, and they were perfectly capable and willing to write that chapter to the agnostic, as was Lois, Bill's wife, prepared to write the chapter to wives. And Bill Wilson. Bill Wilson was a lot of things, but he was a very arrogant man. And his arrogance, he refused to let anybody else do that. Anyway, I got myself off the trailing. But anyway, I stayed sober. I didn't drink. I stayed sober, and I sort of I navigated. I became to realise, and up until that point, I probably wouldn't have described myself as an atheist. I just didn't believe. It really wasn't an issue in my life. I'd been raised a Catholic. I might have mentioned that before, but the Marist brothers and the Vincentian fathers had belted any bloody religion out of me very early in the piece. I had no respect whatever, certainly for any of the religions, and no belief in any sort of God. So it wasn't until I'd come back and been sober, for a few years, I think, that I'd sort of realised, I am an atheist, because atheism isn't a belief. Atheism's a conclusion. Atheism is something that where one arrives after a whole lot of thought and investigation and research. Well, that's what happened to me anyway. And that's it. So I had to navigate around this, and it took a while. I think initially I just took the I didn't worry too much about the steps. I really didn't. I hadn't needed them the first 10 years, all those years ago, and I didn't feel I needed them too much this time. And so that's what I did. Now, that sort of kept me going for about 16 years. And I had periods where I was sort of happier. And I mean, I was always happy to be sober. I was never unhappy to be sober. But there were times when I was happy in sobriety. There were times when I was probably less happy. And around about 2016, 2017, I sort of reached a stage where I frankly wasn't all that happy in sobriety. I found it difficult to go to meetings. But I knew from my previous experience I had to go to meetings. You know, I'd looked at a few other avenues and what have you, and I knew that AA wasn't the only game in town, but it was the only game in town for me. Nothing else, there was nothing else I could see that I felt could or would work for me. So I was stuck with AA, imperfect though it was. So I just got on with it. Now, what happened to me in about 2017, thereabouts, I didn't make a note in a diary. I don't keep a diary. But at somewhere around about that time, I became concerned about the number of people I was seeing being effectively being turned away from Alcoholics Anonymous by this, you know, believe or be gone sort of mantra. I've been talking for half an hour, that's too long. It happened, it was one particular morning that I remember, this wasn't the only one, one particular morning that I remember, I was at a meeting and there was a bloke there who was, I'd known him as a long time, absolute Bible basher. Like this bloke dead set believed that Jesus shared his cornflakes with him. Like he used to sit and have one-on-ones with Jesus over his morning cornflakes. I shit you not, you know, this bloke really believed this. And that's all right. He's entitled to believe that, you know. Well, I'm bloody senile myself these days, so I understand where he's coming from. But this particular morning, there were a couple of newbies in the room, and he made a statement about, oh yes, he knew that there, and he knew I was there, and he knew where I stood. That he'd known a few people in AA that were atheists, but oh geez, they had a pretty shitty sort of a sobriety. I didn't react well. And that sort of set me on a path of discovery, if you like. I started, you know, and bear in mind that I am not of the computer age. I'm closer to the bloody steam age than the computer age. But I started doing a bit of research and what have you, and I discovered there was such a thing as secular AA. I discovered there were people in AA who quite openly didn't believe in God. And some of them had been sober a bloody long time. I learned that there were people there right at the very inception of AA. I mentioned a couple of them before, you know, Jim Burwell and Hank Parkhurst and others. So atheism was nothing new to AA. So I started to make a few inquiries. I found that there were actually secular meetings in Australia, only about five of them, but they were all at cities, you know, sort of a long way from where I am. Australia's a pretty big country. And this is well truly before the days of Zoom. But anyway, I found that there was to be a conference or a convention of secular AA in Toronto in 2018. So my wife and I, we never have been and still aren't very well off, but we had a four-wheel drive and a caravan that we'd done a bit of traveling with, and we sold those. You know, it was hard to part with them. We had an emotional attachment to them. But we sold those to finance a trip to North America, incorporating a visit to that Toronto convention. To say it was life-changing is, and I know that's a hackneyed phrase, but I'm going to use it anyway, because for me, to be in the company of several hundred like-minded people in that room in Toronto in September, I think it was 2018, was truly life-changing. Having felt marginalised as I did for as long as I had here in Australia in traditional AA, and it was just amazing. I came back. We continued that. We did our trip around Canada and North America. Came back, and I teamed up then with another woman. As a female member of AA, who I learned had tried to start a secular meeting here in Queensland, not actually in Brisbane, but 60 or 70 mile away, a year or so before. Now, this woman on her own had tried to start a secular meeting, and she'd had the bloody the Taliban, the bloody AA Taliban, descend on her in droves and shut her meeting down. She was just terrified of the bullying tactics that some of these people used. And her and I made contact with her. We made contact with her. And we got together and we decided we'd open a meeting in Brisbane. And we opened that meeting. It'll be 3 years ago. It'll be 3 years in February, about the time of my birthday. And we opened a secular meeting here in Brisbane. Now, the same bloody bullies and cowards who'd pushed her out, you know, a year or two before, turned up at the meeting. I'm 74 now, so I was just over 70 then. I'm fairly tall, but I'm not much of a threat. But these bloody cowards, as soon as they found that she was no longer a woman on her own, even if her sidekick was a bloody, you know, a geriatric retired truck driver, they took off. They weren't going to deal with a man. It was all right to bully a woman. And that's what happened. Okay, so what happened then was that we started this meeting, and I'd like to tell you that we had to move to a bigger venue to accommodate it. That never happened. Sometimes it was just Helen and I there on my own. Then we get two or three others that turn up. Then we started to get inquiries from people who were too far away to physically come to the meeting. And Helen actually had some of you, a few ladies, are no doubt aware of the sober she-devils in the States. And Helen had association with them. So she knew about Zoom. And Helen's a bit younger than me. She's not quite from the steam age. And so we decided we'd start a Zoom meeting. And we did that in late 2019, long before COVID. So we had a hybrid meeting going here in Brisbane before COVID, and people say, "Oh, you know, geez, you were looking into the future, or you had foresight." No, we didn't. We just identified a need and went and filled it, and then the other shit happened. You know, we didn't know COVID was coming, and of course, COVID came and tipped the world on its side, and now we're all on Zoom. Helen, unfortunately, is no longer a part of it. Helen has an inoperable brain cancer and is very, very unwell. So she hasn't been to her meetings for quite a while. So that sort of brings us up to, and my I am finding, you know, today I'm just so much happier. I love my secular AA. I love the meetings. I love the people. You know, Marsha has been a regular visitor at our meetings here in Australia, as have a lot of other people. Kevin from Seattle, I see here, and I think the lady from Manhattan with the cats. And you're my friends and you're on the other side of the world, for heaven's sake. I don't think I've missed anything important. Today I'm a very happy sober alcoholic. The reason that I am so passionate about this, I think I could still stay sober without secular AA. I wouldn't enjoy it as much as I do, and it would be a whole lot harder. But my aim today, that my passion for secular AA is directed to the newcomer, to that newcomer who's sitting down the back of that room that hopefully might hear me or somebody else say, "Hey, it's all right. It's all right. I'm an alcoholic. I'm sober. I'm an atheist, and I've been sober for 1 year, 10 years, 23 years. Doesn't bloody matter." And that's how I believe we can best carry the do the 12-step work and carry the message to those who still suffer. So thank you very much for the invitation to be a part of this, and I've thoroughly enjoyed it. And as far as I can see, you're all still awake, so I'll count that as a win.